Deutsche Welle, Living Planet.
This week on Living Planet, we meet a forest protector patrolling the threatened tree stands of Cambodia.
In the past, it was a huge forest. It was the home of animals and so much natural life and resources. I could get everything there that I needed to live. But right now, there is almost nothing.
We remember the life of Mindy Baha El-Din, one of Egypt's leading conservationists.
She became involved in kind of conservationist projects and campaigning to get Egyptians to realize beauty of nature that they have there and work to conserve it.
And we swing through the trees with Brazil's golden monkeys.
It's something very special for us to talk to people about the need to protect the forest for the golden lion tamarin, to protect many other species of this fantastic biodiversity.
I'm Saroja Coelho. Welcome to the show. It's International Forestry Day, and to celebrate, Living Planet is visiting two truly magnificent forests on opposite sides of the world, one in Cambodia, the other, later in the show, in Brazil. Our first report introduces us to Mao Chun Tun. She's a woman on the forefront of the fight to save the Prey Lang forest in Cambodia. Prey Lang is the largest remaining lowland evergreen forest on the Indochina Peninsula. And Mao Chun Tun, in her rural world, which is about 8 hours north of Phnom Penh, women are usually farmers and homemakers caring for their children. But Mao Chun Tun has carved out a very different life for herself. She's out on patrols looking for illegal loggers, and she's Prey Lang's best chance for survival. Kyle James reports from Phnom Penh.
In Phnom Penh, a large crowd of people in makeup and hats made out of large leaves march through the streets. They're dressed up like the characters in the movie Avatar. Their message is like the one in the film. Beware of short-sighted economic interests threatening to wipe out an important natural habitat. In this case, it's the Prey Lang forest that needs protection, say the protesters. Its destruction could mean the end of a way of life for tens of thousands of people. Near the city's royal palace, demonstrators kneel and begin a Buddhist prayer, asking for divine intervention in saving Prey Lang Forest. This is a protest movement that is really starting to pick up in Cambodia, where environmental activism is still in its early days. For years, Cambodians were more occupied with recovering from years of genocide and civil war. Now, rapid development has arrived, and some have realized that the country's natural resources are under threat, including Prey Lang. 31-year-old Mao Chun Tun is one of them.
In the past, it was a huge forest. It was the home of animals and so much natural life and resources. I could get everything there that I needed to live. But right now, there is almost nothing.
In fact, the forest plays a vital role in the entire country's ecosystem. Covering an area of approximately 3,600 square kilometers, Prey Lang spreads across four provinces and is home to dozens of endangered species. Seng Sok Heng is with the Community Peacebuilding Network, a nationwide NGO in Cambodia that works on natural resource issues.
Prey Lang is also very important for the local community, as people depend on it for their livelihoods. They get food like vegetables, mushrooms, and honey, but there are also traditional herbs for medicine and construction materials. It's like the bank, but for the local community.
But that bank is facing insolvency. Large agribusiness firms have been granted economic land concessions, large areas of land often cleared for rubber plantations or for other uses. Although the Cambodian government has said that new economic land concessions are no longer being granted, Prey Lang is still being cut down. Mining operations threaten pristine areas, and illegal logging for valuable wood is rampant. Government protections are weak, and some reports say if things don't change, Prey Lang will simply vanish in as little as a few years' time. That would have a devastating impact on the environment and people's lives, especially the indigenous Kui community, Svay Pern is a member of this ethnic minority.
The Kui group won't be able to make their living collecting non-timber materials from the forest. More of us will have to migrate from our homes to look for work elsewhere.
Activist Mao Chun Turn, who's one half Kui herself, says that can't happen. Several years ago, she started taking action.
Every month, I stop farming and go on forest patrols in a group. We take video cameras and record what we find to take evidence to government forestry officers. Our team apprehends smugglers and illegal loggers.
Those activities aren't without risks. Powerful people are often behind land clearing in Cambodia, and they don't look kindly on the actions of activists. Illegal logging can be attractive to desperately poor people or even soldiers who are sometimes armed.
Of course, I'm afraid of being shot sometimes, but I simply can't think like that. I've devoted my life to the whole forest and the community. I'm trying to take care of the forest for my child's generation, not just my generation.
Even when she was pregnant, Mao Chun Turn continued going on patrols. Her son was born in January 2012, and she named him Rus Prey Long, which means Prey Long is alive. Mao Chun Turn was a driving force behind the current highly visible Avatar campaign, which made her the face of the movement. But she also works on more prosaic matters, like debating here with other activists about how to best lobby the government to put stronger protections in place. But her activism has taken its toll. Her husband didn't approve of her activities and left her while she was pregnant. Her forest patrols take her away from her small plot of farmland, cutting into her already modest income. But to her, stopping isn't really an option.
I have to be optimistic. If my network can keep patrolling and protecting the forest, it will still exist. At least some part of the forest will continue to exist. If this movement stays alive, the forest will stay alive too.
And Mao Chun Turn and her community will be able to continue their way of life. Chun Turn hopes that one day she can show her son firsthand why she loves Prey Long the way she does. Kyle James, DW, Phnom Penh, Cambodia.
We're going to visit another forest now, but this time we're actually going to scramble up the side of a tree and perch on a branch. Keep an eye out for a flash of orange fur. It's a monkey. The golden lion tamarin hops and swings through the green forest foliage. It searches the canopy for fruit and insects to eat, using its tail for balance. Now, this scene is an increasingly rare one in Brazil. The golden lion tamarin makes its home in the Atlantic rainforest, but the tree stand has been reduced by more than 80%. That leaves the monkey with very little place to live. But we're about to meet some Brazilian conservationists who are trying to save this little orange monkey. Milton Bragacci has this report.
You need a good pair of boots and trousers to walk through this section of the Atlantic forest, just outside of Rio de Janeiro. The trees are not very tall, but there's lush, thick vegetation, with plenty of undergrowth and lots of mosquitoes. Ahead of us, with a machete in his hand, a strong guy, Elisaman, clears the branches and bushes on our way through. I have to move fast to keep up with him and the rest of the group. Welcome to not bird watching, but monkey watching. We are in golden lion monkey, or more accurately, golden lion tamarin territory. To find these unique monkeys in the middle of the vegetation, we also need the skills of Andrea, who is also ahead of us, carrying a kind of antenna. She's pointing in all directions until the equipment finds a radio signal. A transmitter attached to the animals sends out that signal.
100% melhor do que passar o dia no escritório.
Andrea, who is a local from the area, explains that it's been more than 30 years since she started as a volunteer in this project. Back then, there were only 200 of the golden lion tamarin monkeys in the wild. Now, the number is back up to over 1,000. Andrea has now located a radio signal from one of the monkeys, and we quickly head to the spot she points out to us. We keep still and wait. Suddenly, surprisingly delicate, high-pitched squeals emanate from the trees. We spot a dozen golden lion tamarins with their brilliant orange fur flying from branch to branch. They are smaller in size than newborn babies. They then get closer to eat the bananas brought by Andrea. Up close, they appear smart and almost human-like with their facial expressions. Luis Paulo Ferraz organizes the monkey watching trip. He's executive secretary of the Golden Lion Tamarin Association, the NGO which maintains the project to save the animals that are unique to this area of forest outside of Rio. He says lifting the animals' numbers up again took a long time.
It was needed to make a huge effort involving local owners of the forest that we have here, all the communities, public sector, and the scientists to engage in a strategy to bring animals from zoos from all over the world, especially US and Europe, to reintroduce these animals in the forest. We had important involvement from different zoos, the National Zoo in the United States, Atlanta Zoo, Philadelphia, Frankfurt in Germany, and the local institutions that were engaged in this process.
The Atlantic Forest, known to the locals as Mata Atlântica, is scattered down the east coast of Brazil and contains one of the richest assortments of unique plant and animal species in the world. But some 190 animal species and 300 plants in the forest are considered threatened. That's because the forest is dwindling in size, still at an alarming rate. The pressure comes from development and human population. This region here in Rio de Janeiro State was declared a permanent protected area, where farmers and owners are required to keep or restore native vegetation. Surrounded by small farms, this particular section, called Poço das Antas, is located an hour from the city center of Rio de Janeiro, also a place where monkeys are a common sight. In Rio, not far from famous beaches like Copacabana and Ipanema, you might spot them. Other species, not the golden lion tamarin, climbing on trees near hilltops. Taking the cable car to the postcard view of Sugarloaf or Corcovado, they are everywhere. They love to scavenge for food thrown to them by tourists. The attraction and sympathy felt here in Rio for the monkeys is a key factor for the success of the project to save golden lion tamarin back in the Atlantic Forest, says Luis Paulo from the Golden Lion Tamarin Association.
The people like the animal, and it's something very special for us to talk to people about the need to protect the forest for the golden lion tamarin. Doing that, we are also doing the same process to protect many other species of this fantastic biodiversity of this ecosystem called Atlantic Forest, one of the most threatened ecosystems in terms of tropical forests in the world.
Back on the monkey watching trip in the forest, Didi and her husband, who are visiting from Belgium, are impressed by the conservation efforts to save the animal.
It is just wonderful to see that and to see also all the efforts that people do to keep the chain alive and to keep the species in a good health. And how
does it feel to be running around looking for a monkey?
I think it's even more exciting, more exciting than bird watching. Yeah.
And I'd have to agree, it's great to see the increasing monkeys here, from only a couple of hundred 3 decades ago to the situation now, where they are not too hard to spot. But Luis Paulo says the project still needs to be monitored closely.
The last reintroduction was done in 2000, so we are not reintroducing animals in the wild anymore. Why? Because today our main problem is we have now the third generation of those animals that were brought from zoos, but today our main problem is the lack of forest. This is considered by many specialists as a model project of initiative to save a species from extinction.
Certainly, it's been successful. But still, the overcrowding of this section of shrinking forest shows that there will be future challenges to come in the campaign to protect Brazil's golden lion tamarin and its habitat, the Atlantic forest. Milton Bragatti, DW, Rio de Janeiro.
Welcome back. You're listening to Living Planet. We're going to take a moment now to honor the life of a conservationist who made a huge contribution to Egypt's growing environmental movement. Mindy Baha El-Din was Egypt's Secretary of Nature Conservation. She was a bird lover and an important ally for young environmentalists. We're joined now by Arwa Abu-Rawa, a journalist who interviewed Mindy Baha El-Din not long after the start of the Arab uprisings. Arwa, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Now, if you could tell us, for the listeners who don't know a lot about Mindy Baha El-Din's work, maybe you could tell us who she was.
Well, Mindy first came to Egypt back in 1988 on a project for BirdLife International to kind of establish a conservation education center in Giza Zoo. She was very passionate about the environment. She was very passionate about birds. And she came to Egypt with kind of a mission. And she never really left. I mean, she stayed. She fell in love with the country. She loved to travel to see the coastal side of Egypt. She loved marine life. She loved the wetlands. And she stayed in Egypt for a very long time. And she became involved in kind of conservationist projects and campaigning to kind of get Egyptians to realize beauty of nature that they have there and to kind of work to conserve it.
The idea was that she was going to study, and then she met Sherif Baha El-Din, and together they became the leading couple of the green movement in Egypt.
Mindy was really passionate about birds. She was a real bird lover, and one of the kind of renowned ornithologists in Egypt was a man called Sherif Baha El-Din. And when they met, they clearly had a lot in common, and there was a spark between them. So they eventually got married and had children, and they kind of became like a celebrity power couple for the environment in Egypt. I mean, they were really influential in a lot of their campaigns. They worked together. I mean, one of the first campaigns they worked on was to kind of stop bird hunting in Egypt. And through that, they became quite influential, and they were able to kind of inform government policy in terms of protecting the environment. So they were a really influential couple, and it's really sad to see Mindy go.
When they started that kind of work, actually the dictator, Hosni Mubarak, was still in power. There wasn't a lot of mobility for Egyptian environmentalists, and certainly this was a unique couple because she had American status as well and a lot of connections outside of the country. Could you tell me a little bit about what it might have been like for them at that time to be campaigning under the dictator?
I think it was a quite difficult kind of balance to work with, in the sense that she was quite critical of some government policies, and she was quite critical of poor funding, poor regulation. But she obviously had to be very careful about what she said publicly. But after the revolution, I mean, you saw a huge transformation in the way that Mindy kind of campaigned. She was a lot more open in her criticism. She was more public about things that needed to be done. So it was kind of great to see a flourishing in her kind of activism and kind of becoming a bit more of a public figure, in the sense that she was happy to talk to journalists now. She was happy to put her name to things. In a sense, people think conservationism is something for kind of older people, and she wanted to bring to it a bit of buzz. And the way she wanted to do that was by putting it on social media sites like Twitter. So she wanted to make it a real personal story.
Well, speaking of personal stories, I'm interested in how you got to know her.
I guess I kind of got in touch with her first by Twitter and Facebook, and I started hearing a lot about her. And she got in touch with me about a campaign she was working on to stop a development project in Lake Qarun. And it was after that I got speaking to her about her work and the things that she'd done. I mean, she's been in Egypt for a couple of decades now, so she's seen a lot of changes as well. So I was really fascinated by that. So I really wanted to have a big kind of interview with her about how things were 20 years ago, how things have changed, how she feels about the Arab Spring and the revolution, what she hoped that the future will hold.
What did she tell you? What did she say it was like 20 years ago?
She said that things have gotten worse, in a sense, because there's more development projects, there's overpopulation, and there seems to be less funding for conservation projects. So she'd seen a lot of degradation really happen to the kind of environment she loved and she really cared about. But she was always really positive, and even though she had such problems in terms of getting money for conservation projects and helping protect the environment, she was always positive that something would come along, something would change, and that the people would kind of shift, the attitude would shift about nature.
Could you give me a specific example of something that she was excited about, something that she thought she could change?
I guess it was following the Arab Revolution. She was really passionate about engaging younger people. She was really wanting younger campaigners that were maybe campaigning on things like street harassment or campaigning on debt and poverty in Egypt to kind of see the links between them issues and conservation and environmental issues. And she was really keen on getting younger people involved in this agenda because she saw that they were the future and they were the people that were going to be conserving the environment in kind of the years to come.
I'm interested to know how it is for you. You are a green journalist, so you write a lot about environmental issues, about social issues related to environmentalism. And I'm wondering, as a young person coming up in the world, and here we've got this situation where there's been an uprising, there are a lot of new opportunities. Do you feel like you have role models? Do you feel like you have people from an older generation of environmentalists who can say, this is what it was like when we were doing it, and we have these lessons to offer to you? Or was Mindy a standalone example?
I mean, I think generally in the environmental movement, kind of globally, a lot of the kind of big actors tend to not originate from the Middle East and North Africa region. So there isn't actually a lot of kind of role models that young campaigners can kind of look up to. And Mindy was one of the few people, actually, that was really open about sharing information she had, sharing her experiences. And so I think that in that sense, she was really, really valuable. And it's a real loss to kind of the whole environmental movement across the region that she's kind of passed away, because she had so much knowledge with her and she was so generous with her time. So it is a real loss to the whole environmental movement.
Thing I'm curious about asking you about is her efforts to end fishing in the Ras Mohammed National Park.
Well, the Ras Mohammed is actually a national park, so it is actually protected in terms of the flora and the fauna. And yet there was a lot of aggressive fishing that was happening there, and she saw that it was really destructive to marine life and the ecology around the area. She was working really hard to stop that and to protect it. Mindy was really realistic about the environment that a lot of Egyptians lived in. She knew that there's a lot of poverty and that people sometimes exploit resources because of that poverty. She kind of wanted to look long-term for herself and for Egyptians, in the sense she wanted to conserve these really important kind of ecosystems that Egyptians enjoy for the kind of long term. I mean, she recognizes that people might exploit them now because they're desperate, but she wants the resources to be there for the generations to come so that the children of these people can kind of enjoy this resource. And so she really tried to work hard with locals to kind of educate them about the importance of conservation in the long term and kind of how to use resources sustainably so that they can be enjoyed in the future. I mean, I hope that the time she spent sharing that information and that knowledge with people will become more powerful now, as people will step up and kind of realize that they had to take on her role and to kind of keep that knowledge alive. So hopefully her legacy will live on in all the time that she shared with people and all the knowledge she's passed on, so that in the long term, there's more people out there who are passionate about conserving the environment in Egypt and in the wider region.
Arwa Abu Rawa is a freelance journalist specializing in environmental issues in Cairo, Egypt. She has been helping us remember the life of Mindy Baha El-Din, one of Egypt's leading conservationists, who died earlier this week of a stroke. Arwa, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're moving now to the topic of the oil sands in Canada. The oil sands refers to a very thick form of petroleum known as bitumen. In northern Alberta, that's a province in Canada, they have the world's second largest petroleum reserves after Saudi Arabia's oil fields. The mining of bitumen and its conversion into usable fuel requires large amounts of energy, which in turn produce greenhouse gases. Global opposition to the project is growing. Critics say expanding oil sands imports runs counter to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Well, now Germany's Helmholtz Center for Environmental Research has declared a moratorium on oil sands environmental work. They are concerned that their reputation could suffer if they are involved with the project. I'm joined now by Professor Reinhard Hüttl, who is the coordinator of the Helmholtz Alberta Initiative. Professor Hüttl, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Can you tell me how the Helmholtz Center for Environmental Research was involved in the tar sands project?
This was started about 4 or 5 years ago when the president of our National Science Foundation, Professor Kleiner, visited Alberta, and he found open cast mining as an interesting basis for basic research. And the Helmholtz Association, that consists of 18 national labs in Germany, was ready to undertake basic research, and we are 4 centers that are involved in this research, and one of these 4 centers is the Environmental Research Center in Leipzig.
What was the work exactly?
The work was that we have the background of the reunification of the two Germanys in the late 80s, early 1990s of the last century. And we had a lot of environmental problems to solve, particularly with open cast mining of lignite. And we have been active with actually billions of euros to remediate and minimize the related environmental problems. The president of our National Research Foundation went to Canada and he found similarities. And therefore, we tried to transfer our knowledge for a better environmental aspect related to the oil sand production.
Well, I'm interested then why you have decided to put a moratorium on the work that was being conducted there.
Out of the 4 centers that are involved in the Helmholtz-Alberta Initiative, 1 center discussed this question. The background, I think, is that we have a discussion here in Germany with regard to our energy turnaround, the Energiewende, and we are concentrating all our efforts now into renewable energy systems. And we also have the question of climate protection and CO2 control. And the debate that is going on in our society, in our political parties, in the government, is related to these aspects, and it is these debates that made the Environmental Research Center come to this conclusion and to this intermediate decision. I can only say that the University of Alberta and Edmund is an excellent university. We find ourselves very happy that we can work with them in the fields that I do. We work on geothermal energy, we work on questions of CCS, carbon capture and sequestration, and we also work on basic research, soil development and ecosystem development after impact of man on questions like service mining.
When a prestigious center like the Helmholtz Center pulls out, what message does it send to the international community?
It's not a final decision. It is a moratorium means that for the time being, a project that is related from this center into the oil sand research are discontinued. I would appreciate that if one does production in this field with oil sands, the same is true for gas, for unconventional gas like shale gas or shale oil, that one would imply the best possible technologies for environmental protection. Of course, it's a question whether you do it at all or you don't do it. If I see the energy demands on a global perspective, my perception is that we will use all these resources, but we can only use them in a sustainable and environmentally friendly way. And if you can apply the relevant technologies, that would be an appropriate approach.
Professor Reinhard Hüttl is with the Helmholtz Alberta Initiative. Thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Take me wandering through these streets where bright lights and angels meet.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of Living Planet. Thank you for tuning in. I'll be back again next week with more news and stories about the environment. For now, I'm Sarojja Coelho. From everyone here in studio, thanks for listening. Stone to stone.